What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping you?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN Radio. This is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, we would love to get that question answered so that you don't have to, walk around wondering all the time. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're listening to us outside of North America, please dial the U.S. country code and then 205-271-2985. You can also shoot us an email if you prefer that. ctc@ewtn.com is the address. ctc@ewtn.com. Michael McCall is our producer today. We also have Matt Kubinski handling the phones. Jeff Burson is on social media. If you want to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook Live, Jeff will see it if you put it in the comments box. And then he'll send it to us here in the studio. Hopefully we can get that question answered. Again, the phone number 833-288-EWTN. And if you call right now, we can probably get you screened and get you on the air really quickly. I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
Great. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing decent. Thank you.
A little shout out to a couple of visitors that we had here in our studios. Adam from Covenant Network. He does a morning show there for our friends in St. Louis. We also had Jen Brown from Spirit Catholic Radio. She does the morning show there. And what a delight to meet both of them.
How wonderful.
Wonderful folks in town for a couple of days here. And let's get to some of these emails. Here's one from Connie. Please explain the communion of saints. My confusion lies between praying only to canonized saints and praying to any dead person. What is the difference there? Could you please explain and clarify? Thanks, Connie.
Yeah, thanks. So if we only prayed to canonized saints, no saint could ever be canonized.
True.
Because one of the conditions for canonization is that their intercession has to be found effective miraculously. So by definition, you can't make it to canonization unless people are asking for your prayers and intercession.
That's how it works.
Right. And there's certainly nothing wrong with asking for the prayers and intercession of any holy person whom you personally believe to be in heaven. Now, let's say you're wrong. Let's say they're not in heaven. What have you lost? Nothing.
Nothing.
No prayer is ever wasted.
Right.
Right. So you're safe. Right. What canonization gives us is when a saint is canonized, now that person's cult, and don't take that word in the sociological sense.
Right.
It just means the veneration that is paid to a saint. That particular saint's devotion or cult can be publicly celebrated throughout the entire universal church. Like, they have the approbation of the Holy See that this is something that can be included in the church's liturgy and included in public celebrations of the Catholic faithful. Whereas, you know, for example, I'll ask my father and some of my spiritual mentors who have passed on to pray for me. They don't get a day in the church's calendar. You're right. They get one in my calendar, but they don't get one in the church's calendar.
You're
They're not going to be promoted publicly as saints in the church, unless, of course, their calls to canonization were completed.
Okay, very good. And thank you so much for your question. While we're on the subject of saints, we got this email from Tim. And Tim can't tell where he's from, but Tim says, does the Orthodox Church recognize the saints who have been canonized after the divide? That would be the Great Schism in 1054. Or do they simply not recognize any saints after this? Related to this, did the Orthodox Church begin canonizing their own saints after splitting from Rome? And if so, how does the Catholic Church view these, quote, saints, unquote? Thanks, Tim.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. So the Orthodox communities do have their own saints that they venerate and whose intercession they seek, including many of those who were raised to the altar after the split in 1054, some of them quite modern. Now, to be honest with you, I'm not an expert on the procedure that the Orthodox use to declare somebody a saint. I just couldn't tell you. It's not my not my tradition, mm-hmm. not my area of expertise. In terms of how does the Catholic Church view these, with respect. Now,
sure.
because they weren't subject to the Holy See's investigation, and so it's not been something proclaimed by the Holy See. They're not included in the church's calendar and the way of public cult that the saints of the Catholic Church are. And yet you will find popes, I think it was John Paul II, for example, referred to, or maybe it's Benedict, I can't remember, Serafima Sarov, who's a well-known Orthodox Russian saint, uh-huh. as a saint.
Oh, okay.
You know, but not in a kind of official pronouncement, but just sort of in casual conversation in a Wednesday audience, you know.
Right.
So it was a saintly, holy person and so forth. So we view them with respect.
Very good. And Tim, thank you for your email. And I did want to get his location in. He's listening in Ephrathah, Washington. Ephrathah in Washington. Here's a question from Carol watching us right now on YouTube. Catholics often say heaven and earth meet at Mass and the Eucharist makes Christ present. Isn't that the case at all times? Or do you just believe the intensity of the presence is greater at Mass?
This is such a fantastic question. I may have to get started now and keep going after our mandatory break.
Okay.
So let me get started now. God is with us. God is present to us in several different modes. Several different modes. So one of the most sublime modes of the divine presence is what we call the divine immensity. What do we mean by that? Well, what we mean is that God is not located in time and space. And so his ubiquity, his omnipresence, should not be thought of like a gas diffused through a room, as if there were more of God in an elephant than in a mouse. God is not present in that way. He's present to us more like, say, the way, you know, the number three or the number one is present to me. Like unity is a constitutive aspect of my being, as it is to Tom and as it is to an aardvark. Now, I don't have one version of the number one and Tom another version of the number one and the aardvark a third version. We all participate in that same unity represented by the number one. Unity is not something that is located in time and space. It's a universal principle we call a transcendental that can be predicated of any and all modes of being. All right? God is present to reality in something like that way, in a transcendental way, where all of God is always present to every aspect of reality simultaneously. Now, let me come back to this business about the divine presence after the break.
Very good. And by the way, if there are any aardvarks listening right now, Matt will put you at the head of the line. I'm telling you. 833-288-EWTN is our phone number. 833-288-3986. Call to communion on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN. Stay with us. Call to communion here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. We got a couple of lines in the screening process right now, but there's a line available for you at 833-288-3986. We're going to go back to Carol's question in just a moment. First, I want to tell you about a new book available from EWTN Publishing, Living Calm, Mastering Anger and Frustration by Dr. Ray Guarendi. Hey, this is the book you need to master your anger so that your anger won't master you. Dr. Ray unpacks the many types of anger and the types of people who suffer the most from anger. You'll learn why feelings aren't neutral and whether anger is a product of your nature or your nurture. You'll also learn the difference between righteous and unrighteous anger. There is a difference. And why those closest to us can anger us the most. Doesn't that happen sometimes? Again, a great book, Living Calm, Mastering Anger and Frustration by Dr. Ray Guarendi. Available right now at EWTNRC.com. Buy Catholic, shop Catholic, EWTNRC.com. We are going to go to the phones in a moment here. We'll begin with Louise in Denver. But first, see, I read your mind there, David.
Good.
All right. Let me recap the question that we began before the break from Carol watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Carol's comment was, Catholics often say heaven and earth meet at Mass and the Eucharist makes Christ present. Isn't that the case at all times? or do you just believe the intensity of the presence is greater at Mass? Please continue.
Yeah, awesome. So the question of the nature of the divine presence is profound and beautiful and edifying. So before the break, I started detailing one mode of divine presence, namely what we call the divine immensity. This means that God is always everywhere present to everything with all of his being. So there's not more of God in an elephant than in a mouse, or more of God in an aardvark than in an ant. But all of God is present to all things at all times. And it's because of the divine being that every individual thing that exists, that every concrete particular being has its being. Our life, our being, is a participation in the divine being. St. Paul says, in him we live and move and have our being. Now, we cannot have a direct, concrete, sensible experience of the divine immensity because it transcends our sensorial capacities. My eye can only see the particular. So the closest to that we can come in our sensible experience would be to things like beauty. When I encounter beauty in a physical object, it evokes something transcendent in me and calls me beyond myself to something that I do not know and that I cannot see, to that place from whence all the beauty comes. And so this is one of the reasons, for example, that Catholic architecture, Catholic art, Catholic music seeks to evoke the transcendent. You walk into the medieval cathedral and you have these incredibly high vaulted ceilings that seem to call you out of yourself. You step in and the most hardened atheist feels like he stepped into something sacred and transcendent. And it evokes the transcendence of God in what we call the divine immensity. So clearly, when we go to Mass, it's not the only place, but when we go to Mass, one of the things that the Catholic seeks to do in the divine liturgy is to evoke this aspect of the divine presence. Now, your question, is it more intense in Mass? Well, we just got finished saying that this mode of the divine presence can't be more in one place than or another by definition, but I can evoke it more or less effectively in whatever artistic or musical modes I seek. Mm-hmm. So that's one mode of the divine presence, definitely present at Mass, evoked at Mass in a unique way, but not only to be found in the Mass. Here's another way God is present to us. He's present to us by his omniscience. God's knowing me and knowing all things at all times. That's sort of similar to the divine immensity, but it focuses more on divine cognition rather than divine being. And that's another way in which God is certainly present at Mass, but not uniquely so. He'd be like that presence sort of anywhere. All right. Now, here is a mode of divine presence that is unique in the Mass, and that is the presence of the body and blood of Christ, the incarnate Lord. The body and blood of Christ. Now, the body and blood of Christ are present in a mysterious mode, in a sacramental mode, whereby Christ can be seated at the right hand of the Father in heaven and simultaneously distributed under all of the consecrated species throughout the world without any diminution of his person, without any division in his person. So when the priest at the fraction, when he breaks the host, Jesus is not broken in half. The host is broken in half, but Christ's the presence of his body and blood is not thereby destroyed, because it's there at a mysterious mode, a substantial mode, where the attributes, the properties of quantity and divisibility are not present. Now, this is a profound mystery, and it lies at the heart of the Catholic faith and the heart of the liturgical experience. That's not something that you can get outside of Mass, except perhaps in the reservation of the Blessed Sacrament, like in a pyx or an adoration mm-hmm. chapel or a tabernacle. Mm-hmm. So that is unique. That is a unique mode of the divine presence. Now, wherever you have the body and blood of Christ, you also have the soul and divinity of Christ along with it. Theological word to describe that is concomitance, means coming along. If you have the body and blood, you have the soul and divinity along for the ride, concomitance. Now, there's one exception to that rule, or would have been, St. Thomas raises this question, the Summa Theologica, third part, question 81, article 4. He says, what would have happened if the apostles had celebrated Mass when Christ was in the tomb? What would have been present in the sacred elements? And Thomas's answer is, you would have had body, blood, and divinity, but his soul had descended to hell. So he wouldn't have had a soul, because the soul and body were separated at that time. And the proper terminus of the sacrament is body and blood. So whatever comes along with body and blood, that's what you get in the Blessed Sacrament. Normally, body, blood, soul, and divinity. Now, there's another mode of the divine presence we can talk about at Mass. Okay. Another mode, all right? In the Mass, we have the ritual presentation, of Christ's body and blood separated. Now, they're not actually separated. They're whole and entire. Christ is raised from the dead, never to die again. But they're presented in a state of victimhood, double consecration, bread over here, wine over there, representing Christ's body and blood in a state of victimhood. All right, so that's why we call the Mass the memorial of Christ's death, because it shows forth the death of Christ. It took place once for all, can't ever be repeated, right? But it demonstrates to us what occurred on Calvary. Now, the Mass also makes present to us the fruits of Calvary. The effects of the redemption are brought home to us in the Mass. And so the benefits of Christ's death are made present to us. Now, because Christ's death occurred only in the past, it does not recur. It does not happen again. That is located in space and time. We are physically and spatially and temporally distant from the effects of, from the fact of Calvary. We do not time travel back to Calvary, all right? Nevertheless, the intent, so in the mind of Christ, in his mind, Christ intends by Calvary to offer himself to the Father on our behalf. That intent, that purposeful desire to function as a priest on our behalf is eternal. That attitude in Christ remains to this day. In the same way that a man might pledge his love to his wife on his wedding day, right? That determination to be united to his wife is not a once and done thing. It's a perpetual mode of being, right? In the same way, Christ's habitually oriented to intercede for the church with the Father, intercede on our behalf. So that sacrificial intent of Christ is eternal, and we can participate in that. When we go to Mass, we offer ourselves along with Christ. We offer our, St. Paul says, offering your bodies in living sacrifice is your spiritual act of worship. The Mass is the rational worship of the church, whereby the Christian enters into the self-offering, the eternal self-offering of Jesus, and makes that our own, assimilating our own lives to his life of sacrifice. Now, that expression of our communion with Christ is not uniquely expressed in the Mass. We can certainly enter into Christ's self-sacrifice in other ways, but this is the privileged liturgical expression of the passion of Christ to which our lives are to be assimilated.
Carol, a terrific question. Thanks so much for it. And obviously, not something we could answer in a flip way. It takes a little time to unpack these things. If you want to listen to the podcast, check it out. Michael will have it posted for you in a couple of hours at ewtnradio.net, ewtnradio.net. And if you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Louise is our first caller. She herself is a first-time caller from Denver, listening on the Ave Maria Radio app. Hey, Louise, what's on your mind today?
Hi. So I was wondering if Dr. Anders could explain what we mean, or what the church means when we say Christ descended into hell for 3 days. I guess I'm just curious what he did there.
Yes, great, fantastic. Appreciate the question. Thank you. So between the death on the cross on Good Friday and Christ's resurrection on Sunday morning, Christ's body and soul were separated. That's what death means. And the church teaches by the descent into hell that Christ descended to the realm of the righteous dead of the old covenant. So we're not talking about the hell of the damned here. We're talking about more like the abode of the dead, in particular the righteous dead of the old covenant, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all the prophets and so forth. And he liberates them by the proclamation of his own victory over death is present in him. He is demonstrating to them his victory over death. That is his proclamation to them. And when he ascends into heaven, he makes it possible also for them to ascend along with him. Before Christ, there's no beatific vision for the souls of the just. Now that Christ has gone to heaven, that's open to all of the saints. But something else also happens by Christ's descent into the dead. You can sometimes see this in iconography at the baptism. At the baptism, when Jesus' baptism is presented artistically as a kind of descent into the tomb, a kind of anticipation of death and resurrection. And the church teaches that by our baptism, that we share mystically, in a way, in this whole idea of death and descent and resurrection to new life. And so the Christian life itself is a participation in this mystery of the Lord's passion, of his death, of his descent, and his rising again to new life and ascension to heaven. And in our own spirituality, we have to descend to the depths of our personality to root out vice and unholiness and to unite every part of ourselves with Christ, and then rise again with him to new life and ascend with him in illumination to the vision of eternity. And baptism both creates, causes, and figures that in our own souls, and all of the sacraments confirm and deepen it.
Great question, Luis. Thanks for your call. I think a lot of people confuse that where they hear, oh, he descended into hell. But it's not, as you say, the abode of the damned.
Words are ambiguous.
Boy, howdy. It's true. Luis, thanks so much for your call. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN. Going now to Williamsburg, Virginia, listening to Bob on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today, sir?
Great. Hi, Dr. Anders. I'm in Matthew chapter 5. Jesus says, I have not come to destroy the law or the prophets, but to fulfill them. And then he says, amen. Until heaven and earth pass away, not a single letter or part of a letter of the law will be undone. But we know Jesus doesn't follow the law, dietary laws, and even stoning of the adulterous woman. So the church fathers, or do we know what laws Jesus is specifically talking about? Is it the Ten Commandments, or is it some other?
Yep, we know. We know.
Okay.
We do know. We know the answer. Thank you. I appreciate the question. St. Paul gives us the explanation for this in a number of passages of his letters, 1st and 2nd Corinthians and Galatians in particular. And the secret, and it is a secret, Christ speaks about it as a secret, revealed to his initiates, to his disciples, is that the law has a spiritual meaning, and that the letter of the law is a letter that kills, Paul says, but the Spirit gives life. And in Christ, the true meaning and significance of the law is made evident to us. Now, Christ himself intimates this in a number of places. In Matthew chapter 19, for example, when the Pharisees ask about the legality of divorce, and Christ says this is ruled out, this is not possible. They said, well, then why does the law of Moses permit it? He says, because of your hardness of heart. But it wasn't like that from the beginning. And he points to a text from the book of Genesis. God is joined together, let man not separate. And so Christ sets up within his understanding of the Mosaic law a kind of hierarchy of value. And he recognizes that there are some aspects of the law that take preeminence over the others, and some that are to be considered a kind of concession to human weakness, given the culture and times of Israel in Bronze Age antiquity. And so it's not that the law, even those passages of the law, have no value, but their value is not to be taken at face value, as if the point of the law was for us to slavishly adhere to all the details of the Mosaic legislation, but rather the entire law is fulfilled, that's what Christ is pointing to, by the coming of Christ, the elevation of Christ in our hearts, and the life of, and the law of love, love of God and love of neighbor.
Does that make sense to you, Bob?
No, yes, it does. And what about the other part, the prophets?
Okay.
Sure. So the prophets are inspired scripture. Christ cites them. He says that they speak of him. The prophets write in a mysterious way. They speak about events contemporaneous to themselves. They rebuke Israel for its waywardness, and they make predictions about current events in their own lifetime. And yet, at the same time, those same prophecies are a kind of intimation of spiritual events that will be fulfilled in Christ. And no more clear example of this than Isaiah 53 and the various other servant songs of Isaiah that at one level seem to be writing about the experience of Israel in exile, but in another are fantastic, beautiful, prophetic anticipations of the sufferings and resurrection of Christ.
Bob, thanks so much for your call. Appreciate hearing from you in Williamsburg, Virginia. In a moment, we'll go to Houston and talk with Grant, also Howard in Savannah, Georgia. A couple of lines open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on EWTN. Hey, what's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? Let's talk about that here on EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. We do have a couple of lines open at the moment, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Let's go to Grant right now in Houston, listening on the great Guadalupe Radio. Grant, what's on your mind today?
I was wondering what my question I posed to the call screeners, what advice would Dr. David Anders give to a single 30-year-old male from Texas who is a convert to Catholicism and has a capacity for intellectual advancement, but also has trouble integrating the heart with the mind? And I particularly ask because Dr. David Anders is somewhat of a father figure to me, and it seems like he's at the other end of raising kids and a family and has almost finished the pilgrimage. And I'm still in the midst of it.
Yeah, thanks. I like everything you said except the part about me being almost done with the pilgrimage. I hope I'm not almost done with
quite,
the pilgrimage.
Not quite.
Actuarially, I'd say I have at least another 30 years to go, you know.
No, or more.
Thank you for the kind words. I appreciate that. So of course, the intellectual life is a great gift. It's a great blessing. It is also a danger. It's also a danger. And the church is very clear, the church's intellectuals are very clear, that God is not a concept. St. Augustine, you know, God in Latin is Deus, D-E-U-S, four letters. Augustine once said, God is not a four-letter word. And he didn't mean what we mean by that idiom. You know, I mean,
right.
God, or we should say it's not a three-letter word. You know, God is not identical with the terms that we use to describe him. God is a living reality that actually exceeds our capacity to conceptualize. And even our most elevated theological concepts are just baby talk. We're just babbling when it comes to God. And God ultimately is shrouded in a kind of darkness, a brilliant darkness, a luminescent darkness. And there's a theological term for that, too. We call it apophaticism. That we sometimes can approach the nearest to God when we say the least, and when we analyze the ways in which God is unlike our concepts, unlike us, and basically in his essence utterly unknowable. So there's a kind of provisional status to intellectual work, and we will not be saved merely through our intellects, and we don't know God merely conceptually. We have to know God in a participatory manner. Right, we have to be conformed to the divine nature, which is charity. And so, ultimately, I think the great value in intellectual work as a Catholic is to detach ourselves from concepts, to learn the limits of our intellectual abilities, to become disenchanted with ideological views and agendas. And recognize that we can know God best and ultimately only savingly in a participatory way, which happens through charity. So we don't have to leave off the work of the intellect, but it has to be oriented properly towards that realization. That is basically what the Church's mystical path is all about. St. Teresa of Avila, who's one of the great mystics in the Church, and not herself an intellectual, although plenty of intellectuals have studied her, if you ever read her Interior Castle, in my judgment, the Interior Castle is one long exercise in identifying all of the things that are not God. And all the great mystics are very subtle in identifying all of the things that are not. You'd be amazed at the things that are not God. And, you know, people fall into this trap all the time. Well, I know God is, you know, he's not a tree and he's not a stone and he's not a rock. But they have some experience or some idea that they identify, maybe even subconsciously, as ultimate, and fall unwittingly into a form of idolatry. Mm. And the mystics detach us from that kind of thing. So, in terms of the literature, start availing yourself of some of the Church's mystical tradition. Read some of these authors like Teresa and John and Meister Eckhart and, of course, St. Augustine and Bonaventure and the others. Mm-hmm. And that they model for us how to integrate intellectual life with the spiritual path. The pursuit of virtue is, at the end of the day, the whole show. And, virtue is not a concept. Virtue is a habit. And we gain habits by practice. And so you have to, the ultimate focus of the Christian life has to be on practice. It has to be on the practices of justice and of charity and of fidelity and of hoping. When it comes to family life, my own experience and things I do, the same things I do differently, are that kids are amazingly inoculated against concepts, right? And the best way, I believe, to convey the Catholic faith to them is not conceptually. One of my sons told me one time, he said, Daddy, you're always right about everything and nobody cares, which is it was truthful, right? That is the Achilles heel of every intellectual Catholic parent, right?
Quite a buzzkill, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I'll just explain everything to my children and then they'll be good. Just explaining it to them will get the job done.
Sure.
Doesn't work, right? And you know, the flip side of that is I'll just grind them down with lectures and then I'll intimidate them into doing the good. That doesn't work either.
Nope.
That doesn't work either. I think what works is having standards for your children. You know, you're responsible to do this, this, and this, and to avoid that, that, and that. And not convey those standards primarily through lectures or any kind of verbal articulation, but just by laying down the law maybe once, and then enforcing them with consequences and rewards. So, you know, your job is to do the dishes. Johnny doesn't do the dishes. Don't say a word. Don't lecture, no reminders, nothing. And then when Johnny comes back and says, well, I'm going to go watch, you know, my favorite episode of my favorite TV show. Oh, I'm so sorry, Johnny. Didn't you know that if you don't do the dishes, you don't get to watch the TV show? Oh, I'll go do them now. I'm so sorry, Johnny. Well, you need to go do them now. But the rule was if you don't do them, you lose TV for the day. So tomorrow we'll try again. Right? And so you let the consequences do the talking.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how you, that's one way you can build virtue in a child. Also spending time with them so that they can see you exercising the virtues as you engage in common projects and activities together. It's one of the reasons mm-hmm. why children of entrepreneurs and agriculturalists, farmers and so forth, sometimes thrive better than children of other professionals because they grow up side by side with their parents, actually being involved concretely in works of virtue, mm-hmm. not just in abstractions about the faith, not only in catechism class, but actually putting the faith into practice by living well together.
Grant, you're a good man. Keep up the faith, and God bless you, my friend. Thanks for calling. It's called Communion here on EWTN. Couple of lines open at the moment, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Howard is listening in Savannah, love Savannah, on Sirius XM Channel 130. Howard, what's on your mind today, sir?
Good morning, good afternoon, gentlemen. Hey, when you were just talking to that young lady about her, about Jesus' descent to the abode of the holy dead, and he was his mission there to bring the proclamation of his salvation and redemption. How is it that during the transfiguration, Moses and Elijah were with him in the garden with James, John, and Peter?
Sure. Appreciate the question. So these were clearly not the resurrected bodies of the saints that we will receive on the last day, and they would not have been like the resurrected body of Jesus on Easter Sunday morning. These were extraordinary visions that the Spirit of God made available to the apostles for pedagogical purposes. We could liken it, it's kind of analogous to when the angels come and converse with Abraham. Now, angels don't have bodies. Angels don't have bodies. So what is it that's conversing with Abraham? Now, St. Thomas Aquinas, when he examines that question, he actually goes as far as asking whether these angelic bodies would have possessed all of the physiology of a normal human body. And he says no, because they wouldn't have needed it, right? That these were just there as almost like they were cursors, you know, placeholders, so that Abraham would have something sensible to interact with. And I think in a similar way, we'd have to look at this, you know, kind of like, it's not a theophany because it doesn't directly reveal God, but something like a theophany, like when Isaiah sees the Lord high and lifted up, seated on a throne. God doesn't sit on a throne. We don't see him. He's not high and lifted up. He's everywhere. You know, these are metaphors that appear in visionary form to pedagogically to make a certain kind of impression on Isaiah. Something similar is going on in the events of the Transfiguration. These are not the resurrected bodies, not the physical bodies of Moses and Elijah. And of course, physicality is never predicated of them mm-hmm. in this vision. All we know is that they see something.
Yeah.
But, you know, if they got up, you know, tried to touch them, would their hands have passed through? What would have happened? Those kind of questions are not addressed.
Fascinating to think of, you know, I've never heard it used as a cursor.
That just came to me.
Very 21st century for you, young man. Thanks so much for your call. It is called a communion here on EWTN. Earlier in the hour, we were talking about Dr. Ray Guarendi, authoring that new book, Living Calm, Mastering Anger and Frustration, and by a wonderful coincidence, he appears on EWTN Bookmark this weekend with Doug Keck. That'll be on the air Sunday afternoon, at 4:30 p.m. Eastern. Dr. Ray Guarendi joins Doug to discuss how to help moms and dads better deal with child tantrums and bad moods with the great book, Living Calm, Mastering Anger and Frustration. Check it out this weekend on EWTN radio and television. If you're not sure of the times in your area on either radio or TV, do consult EWTN.com. A question here from Ember watching us on YouTube today. Good afternoon, Dr. Anders and Tom. I need some help understanding the words, fear your Lord, words along those same meanings. Thanks and God bless, Ember.
Yeah, thanks. Here's an analogy. I fear my own ability to put my foot in my mouth, to say the wrong thing and get myself in trouble. Something I have done many, many, many times in my life.
Me too.
And when I do it, I'm like, gosh, I wish I didn't do that. Wish I could take that back, right? Mm-hmm. What I'm fearing are the consequences of departing from a kind of virtue. So I have a conception of the good that is wholly good. In this case, the justice and charity of right speech, saying only what is useful for building up others up according to their need. And there's nothing about that that's scary. There's nothing about justice and charity and affability and friendliness and goodwill that's scary. But I have a great fear of departing from that because of the harm that I will cause to myself and others. I think that is a good analogy for understanding the fear of the Lord. God in himself is wholly good. He's wholly good. There's nothing in God itself that is not utterly desirable. In fact, he is the fulfillment of all desire. But I stand in constant need of continually connecting to God in that way, to participating in God, to not falling away from God to the love of creatures in an immoderate way that would deprive me of that blessing of goodness. Now, I should be very afraid of that possibility, just like I'm afraid of failing in a particular virtue, not because the virtue itself is scary, not because God in himself is scary, but the real possibility of not participating in that good is present to me because of my own limited human freedom.
Okay. Appreciate that. Ember, we hope that's helpful for you. Thanks so much for your question and for watching us this afternoon on YouTube. Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. We have an anonymous email here. I am confused about the message of Fatima requiring that we make reparation for the sins committed against the Immaculate Heart of Mary. Could you please explain the theology of this? If it was God's plan to redeem mankind in the way that he did through the atoning sacrifice of Jesus, how can God's plan include sin against Mary?
Okay, sure. Thanks. I appreciate the question. Well, it's very possible for me to sin against another human being. In fact, that is generally the way in which I sin, right? I just got finished talking about the sin of unkind or unjust speech. Well, that's where we malign somebody else, or we defame somebody else, or we backbite, or we quibble, or we complain, right?
Yeah.
So we normally sin against other people. And we sin against people when we fail to give them the dignity, the justice, and charity that they're due. That's what we do. That's exactly what we do.
Yep.
Now, we can do that against living people, people in our immediate environment. We can do it against people that are temporally or spatially distant from us. So just because I don't have somebody sitting right next to me doesn't mean that I can talk nasty about them. In fact, that's backbiting. That could be slander.
Mm-hmm.
What about a heavenly person? Well, could I sin against a heavenly person by speaking ill of them or failing to render them the justice or the honor that is their due? St. Paul says, render to each one what is his due. Honor to whom honor. Custom to whom custom. What's due the Blessed Virgin Mary? Honor. Honor appropriate to her dignity.
Sure.
It's not the same thing as the honor of God, but it's honor.
It is.
I could fail in showing honor to the Blessed Virgin Mary.
Thanks so much for your question. By the way, a quick reminder here, if you want to send us an email for a future show, here is the address, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. A couple of lines open for you. If you want to get in today, we can probably get you on at 833 833- 888-EWTN if you have a question for Dr. David Anders. 833-288-3986. Got an email today from Stephen in Texas who says, "Howdy, I'm struggling in my own head, wondering if I am truly contrite and deserving of forgiveness. This thought has made me wonder if I was really contrite when I went to confession recently. How can the priest be certain that I was? Can't a priest be fooled? How do I know if I'm really sorry for something I've done? I want to go to confession again because it'll probably make me feel better, but I'm sure that's not a good enough reason to return. How can I prepare and be truly sorry the next time I go to confession? Thanks, and God bless, Stephen in Texas."
Great question. Contrition does not involve any sensible emotion. Not essentially. So all it requires is an intellectual recognition that you have done what is objectively wrong and a determination not to do it again, like a willingness to not do it again, recognition that it was wrong and I ought not to have done it, and I am purposing not to do it again. It need not be accompanied by any deep affective experience, any deep emotion. Now, the emotional aspect can be helpful to motivate you. Take, for example, you do something shameful and you're overcome with that very unpleasant sense of shame. Your face is burning and you think, "Oh, good grief, I never want to feel this way again." Well, that emotion can be a help, can be an assist in an act of contrition, but it is not the same thing as contrition. In fact, it's possible to have the emotion without the contrition. You could feel shame and think, "Gosh, I'm sorry I got caught."
Not the same.
All right. And so all you need for contrition is the intent, not the emotion, the intent not to do it again. So when you go to confession and say, "I am sorry for these and all my sins, I'm heartily sorry. I make a firm purpose of amendment. I would like to not do this again." That is by definition contrition. Now, how does the priest know? Because you said, "I'm sorry. Right, preserve me from this and future sins." That's how he knows. Now, could you in fact lie to him? Take an example. Let's say, 13-year-old kid. Mom says, "Time to go to confession." The whole family's packing up, get in the van. He says, "I don't want to go to confession. Sorry, we go to confession on Saturdays. That's the rule." And so he's like, "I'm..." And he goes into the confessional and he says, "This is all just a show. I'm just here to get Mom off my back." So he makes up a fake sin, shot my dad's AR-15 without permission. "I'm sorry." And he didn't, and it's a lie, and he doesn't mean it. Well, the priest wouldn't know in that instance.
Right.
Right? So it wouldn't be a valid confession, and he wouldn't be absolved. But provided that what you say is true and your intent is real, then you don't need all these highly sensitive interior tests to discern whether or not this is real contrition. It's real contrition. That's how the priest decides.
By definition.
You said it.
Right.
That's how he knows.
Okay. Very good. And thank you so much for your email. Here's one now from Cassie. "Dr. Anders, in a recent conversation, I heard that the Queen of England can trace her genealogy back to the biblical King David. I did a quick search on the internet, couldn't find a site that gave any real evidence. Many referred to the Old Testament, but I believe Jesus was the subject of these passages. Do you know anything about this? And moreover, why do some religions cling to such notions? Thanks, Cassie."
Sure. Well, I'm not going to make any comments about the Queen of England, all right, nor about her genealogy.
All right.
I will say this. I think it exceedingly unlikely that any living individual can reliably trace their genealogy to ancient Israel. I think that's just exceedingly unlikely based on the nature of the historical record. However, I think that there are ideological reasons why someone might want to. Because the figure of David, the type of David, recurs throughout Western history as the type of the religious monarch who rules by divine right. And so Charlemagne, for example, would style himself as a kind of David.
Mm.
And anytime you've had Christian monarchy, the comparison to David is very apt, it's very relevant. And so if a monarch or some leader could establish an actual genealogy, well, you know, to somebody's mind, not to mine, but to someone's mind, that might bolster the claim to rule by some sort of divine right. Now, the problem with that theory that you've already articulated is that Christ is the inheritor of the throne of David, and he's still living. He didn't start a dynasty. You know, we don't have, like, you know, the 377th king in the dynasty of the Jesus line. Jesus is still king. And so he has not been supplanted or you know, nor his throne replaced by some progeny, by some scion down the line. That's not how it works. So, you know, at the best you could come up with is a claim to be Jesus' cousin of some sort. Still wouldn't matter. He's on the throne.
He is indeed. Appreciate that. Thank you so much for your email. Here's one now from Carlene. Fascinating for you, David. Dr. Anders, a fellow Catholic recommended one of the Great Courses DVDs on St. Augustine's Confessions by Professors William R. Cook and Ronald B. Herzman. I have read Confessions. I enjoyed it, but found it a little difficult to follow, so I'm interested in some instruction on it. But these professors are not Catholic. Would you recommend this series? And there's a second question here. I was wondering if you've ever thought about or considered doing a Confessions in a Year podcast. It would be great to get your explanations and commentary as we read along. My husband and I are doing The Bible in a Year by Father Mike Schmidt and St. Faustina's Diary in a Year by Father Joe Roach. So a couple of things there from Carlene.
Yeah, thanks. I'm not directly familiar with the Great Courses course on Augustine's Confessions. I have not heard that particular one.
All right.
They generally have pretty talented instructors that know what they're talking about. And so just based on the reputable status of the publisher, I would assume this is a sound course, whether or not the individual in question is Catholic. I actually know one of the professors who's contributed to the Great Courses. The course on medieval philosophy was by a former professor of mine from the University of Iowa, and he was absolutely outstanding, though he's not Catholic. So they're generally pretty good. And Augustine scholarship is a well-established branch of historical intellectual history, and they're, you know, sort of conventional understandings, interpretations. You don't have to be Catholic to know them. So I certainly wouldn't stay away from a book about Augustine or, of course, just because it wasn't written by Augustine. Would I ever consider doing a Confessions in a Year? That's an interesting thought. I'll give you an alternative that I did in a lot faster than a year. I've almost completed now a series on the Catholic faith as a wisdom tradition. The Catholic faith as a wisdom tradition. David Anders, published by the Diocese of Birmingham, our Office of Evangelization and Faith Formation. On that YouTube page, you can find I think probably 6 of the 7 lectures up, in which we do an awful lot of Augustine, because how can you do Catholic wisdom without talking about Augustine?
Sure.
So go check that out, and then if you like it, let me know. Maybe we'll do some more.
Okay. Carlene, thanks so much for your question. Going to go out with this one here from Norma, and Norma says, could you please explain what Mother Mary meant? Now, this is a Fatima quote. Could you please explain what Mother Mary meant by saying, many will go to hell because no one is praying and fasting for them? And she is paraphrasing there.
Yeah, thanks. So we can't save ourselves. That's clear.
Right.
That's teaching of Scripture and tradition. And I think for that reason, too, I think can confirm that. We need grace. We're not adequate unto ourselves. And grace comes to us through other people. We, generally speaking, I mean, God can't just zap you with a lightning bolt of grace from heaven, but that's not normally the way he operates. He operates through intermediaries. St. Paul says we are Christ's co-laborers, as if God were making his appeal through us. That's the way that's the way grace comes to us. And how does the church mediate? Well, it comes through prayer and through works of charity and penance and the holiness of the church. So we're saved through the holiness of the church. That's how grace makes its way to us. So we want to be part of that project. You know, Cardinal Ratzinger, Joseph Ratzinger, before he was Cardinal Ratzinger, wrote a book called Introduction to Christianity. And he said in that book, one is not a Christian because only Christians are saved, but because being a Christian has a meaning for history. And that meaning is that the church mediates God's grace to the world. And, like, we want to be a part of that project. We want to be, I mean, God has set up this giant light bulb. The light of the nations. We have a Vatican document named after that. And I want to be part of that project and shine the light of Christ on the whole world. So get involved. Be a Catholic. Practice the faith. Live the virtues. Pray. Fast. Let Christ's light shine through you. Bring salvation to many.
The more you understand, the more you feel like, at least for me, it was like, I have no choice. I have to be a Catholic.
Yeah, that was me too.
Gotta be. Gotta
Absolutely.
Be. All right, very good. And thank you, Dr. David Andrews. We appreciate all that you do for EWTN.
Hey, Tom, thank you so much for the opportunity. Love working with you.
It's always a pleasure to be with all of you each day, Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern for our live broadcast. And that is on Encore for you at 11 p.m. Eastern each and every Monday through Friday. Do check out the podcast by going to EWTNradio.net, especially because some of these longer answers take a little time to unpack and really digest. Again, check them out at EWTNradio.net. On behalf of our fantastic team, including our guest producer today, Mr. Michael McCall, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Andrews. Thanks for joining us. See you next time here on Call to Communion. God bless.